Hello, and welcome to the Good Librations Podcast.
I'm Lauren.
Good Librations is basically the two of us discussing literary topics and genres at length. I love, you love, we all love storytelling.
We all love storytelling. A quick monthly reminder again to leave us feedback either via the Kiama Library website or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Today's topic is middle grade books.
We're very excited to be speaking to internationally best-selling author A.L. Tate today. But before we do that, on to our first segment, Shelf Absorbed. So I've been reading Race to the End of the World by A.L. Tate.
Love.
Which is awesome. I started reading this with my boys at home, leading up to her book launch at our library recently. And it's just perfect. It has all the elements that appealed to my boys who are 10 and 7. It's full of adventure and maps and monsters and discovery and battles and betrayals and possibility. Like, I could say all the words there.
Yeah.
It's just, it just absolutely captured their imagination and mine too. Like, it was really, it's good for adults who want to read with their children and enjoy what they're reading, you know? I'm looking forward to reading more A.L. Tate books with them for sure.
Yeah, I think they'll love that.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading A.L. Tate too.
Woohoo!
I've been reading The Wolf's Howl, a Maven and Reeve mystery. There's lots of appeal for slightly older readers, but I, a much older reader, am certainly enjoying it for sure. So I love Maven, who is complex and fierce, and Reeve of the good heart.
Love that.
There is a secret society and villains in not only the typical villainous way, but also just in those personalities that you would just, like, rather not with. You know?
Yeah, right.
You know those?
Villains who are just...
Just, oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know?
Those characters that everyone sort of just grates against.
Yeah, right. Yeah, for sure. The mystery itself is really sophisticated and compelling. The setting is suitably spooky, and A.L. Tate has made her fictional, fantastical world not just accessible, but also thematically quite... contemporarily relevant.
Sure.
There are some contemporary themes that mirror things that are going on in our society today, which is very clever.
Very clever.
I'm looking forward to seeing how it all plays out because I'm not finished yet. But two big thumbs up from me so far.
Great.
And now on to Shelf Important, where we discuss the topic of the day.
Now, look, the very title, middle grade books, is a nebulous one. Middle grade books are books suiting ages anywhere between sort of 8 and 14. But how different countries and professions and professionals divvy them up within that space tends to be quite flexible. So at our libraries, for instance, we have a junior collection aimed at 8 to 12 year olds and then a young adult collection aimed at sort of 13 to...
It's about 25.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
18 is sort of officially young adult, but it really kind of climbs up into new adult, doesn't it?
For sure.
Yeah. And then sort of the middle grade books, I think, bridge that gap between the junior and the YA section. So I would consider Harry Potter books or the Nevermore books as middle grade because the characters sort of, they start at age 11 or so, and then they age with the series and climb right up into their higher teens. Taking readers with them from the junior collection into the young adult collection. Keep in mind also that this is all entirely up to preference and reading levels. So my 7-year-old enjoys some middle grade fiction and so do I. And like, I'm most definitely not the target audience, you know, like you said, as an older reader reading that book though, you can appreciate that.
For sure.
Yeah. So I read, Danielle Bink's The Year the Maps Changed recently, and it's such a wonderful examination of a moment in Australia's history, as well as a beautiful depiction of a blended family and living after loss. But it's all done in a way that young readers can understand and be challenged by, but not overwhelmed by, and it was completely stunning, and I feel like I learned so much reading that story within that frame, that middle grade frame. It was beautiful.
Yeah, I think that's what middle grade books do sort of exceptionally well. They posit a sort of historical event, particularly, and sort of place a character in it that inspires empathy.
Sure, sure. You know? Yeah, right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good note.
As far as themes are concerned, middle grade books deal with serious issues, but in a digestible way. So you'll get crushes and maybe first kisses, depending on target audience, but you won't get anything beyond that until you get to the young adult space, really. You're not likely to get any swearing.
Mm-hmm.
Violence is often limited to things like chase scenes or arguments or mellow fight scenes. You'll get themes dealing with gender, sexuality, and mental health, but they will be heavier in the young adult setting than they will be in middle grade.
Yeah.
Children's Books Daily have a great quote on their website about the transition between middle grade and young adult reading. Middle grade novels often feature themes of friendship, family, social issues, and community or wider world issues with relatable central characters. It is common for children to want to read novels with characters who are the same age or slightly older, using the experiences, mistakes, and successes of characters to question how they might face similar realities in their own lives. Through the vicarious experience offered by reading the novels, they have the opportunity to step into other people's shoes, developing empathy and understanding.
Yeah, just which is like what you were saying before.
Sure.
Yeah. So some questions that middle grade fiction likes to answer, and this is from TCK Publishing. Who should I look up or listen to? What kind of relationships do I have with my family, friends, and other people? Which parts of my identity do I want to explore or discard? What should I learn from the people around me? How do I fit in my community? How do I handle conflict?
And I think that this is another really good reason why reading is such a wonderful source of information, because it's not just engaging with a story,
mm-hmm.
you know, particularly at this level, particularly all through YA, really at any level, even at my own stage of life. Reading helps work the stuff out,
sure.
the minutiae of life.
Yeah.
It helps you, you know, rifle through all of the things and pick out what you need to pick out to sort of move forward and develop and,
absolutely.
You know, become who you are, really.
Agreed. And I also was listening the other day to Alison Tate's podcast with Megan Daly from Children's Books Daily, and they were talking, I think it was episode 120, is their most recent one, about how important children's fiction is, because if you didn't foster that love of reading in that age group, you're not going to get adult readers later. That's
really interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, and it's so true. Like, that's such a black and white way of putting it.
Yeah.
But if you don't encourage reading in that age group, there will be no more reading.
Yeah.
Like, it's...
Yeah. Yeah. It's really important.
Yeah.
That they read, not just for their own sort of psychosocial, you know, stuff.
Yes.
But also because... Yeah, moving forward, that you want them to engage.
Absolutely.
And so with all this in mind, we had a chat to middle grade author A.L. Tate. Alison Tate is the internationally published best-selling author of middle grade adventure series The Mapmaker Chronicles, the Atterbarn Cypher novels, the Maven and Reeve mysteries, and now The First Summer of Callie McGee, which is her latest.
Yes, which she launched at Gerringong Library and it was delightful.
Loved it. A multi-genre writer, creative writing teacher and speaker with many years' experience in magazines, newspapers and online publishing, Alison is co-host of the top reading and very popular Your Kids Next Read podcast and former co-host of the very awesome So You Want to Be a Writer podcast.
Yes, that's with the Australian Writers' Centre.
Yep.
Yep. Also, great listening.
Great listening.
Okay, so welcome, Alison, to our podcast. We're very excited that you could be here with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm always excited to be on podcasts. I love talking about reading and writing. It's a lot. I got to say, talking about writing is so much more fun than actually doing it. But anyway, let's not go there.
That sounds we know. Fair, actually.
Yeah.
Okay, so we might start with, we were so thrilled to be able to host the book launch for The First Summer of Callie McGee at Gerringong Library. It was such a fun time. And we were just thinking about that. It's a bit of a genre departure for you, as you describe most of your other books as, I think, adventure, mystery, almost history. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
But then you've set this one in a contemporary setting based on a place that you summered as a child. So why do you think that you went down this path at this time?
Well, to be honest with you, I think that if you look at all of my books as a whole, there's the adventure and mystery aspect remains in this new book. The only thing that's kind of dropped out of this one is this almost history idea. And there's also, like, I couldn't even stay away from it entirely, because there's a little bit of history of the place in there with this, you know, ghost kind of idea that gets introduced at one stage. So there's always going to be a little bit of an element of it. But this particular story was very much inspired by the place. So the place is Jarrowa on the south coast, and it's not so much that I summered there as a child, but that my children did. So we used to go there, stay in a family friend's holiday house, and, you know, there would be a big group of us there all the time. And just the observation of watching all those kids kind of navigate each other within that holiday house environment, because we were together because, you know, I was with my friends, you know, we loved each other. We were having a great time, being as embarrassing as possible to our children. And they were sort of there, and they're kids that know each other because they spend time together about once a year, but they're not what you call besties. They're not, you know, they're not even all the same age. There's sort of like that gap, and just sort of the interesting ways that, and my two children, my two boys are quite different. So one, my youngest one, is very much an extrovert, Mr. How Do You Like Me So Far. He's really social. So, you know, we would get to the holiday house and he'd be in the middle of a ruck before we'd even kind of unpacked the car. Like, he'd be out there doing stuff. Whereas my oldest son, Joe, is very much more introverted and thoughtful. And so it used to take him a little bit longer to kind of find his way in, because when there's only the two of you in a house, it's a fairly small house, you know, a small household, and having your own space is easy to find. In that environment, in a holiday house, it's not. And you're in a bunk room with, you know, six kids, and you're sort of like trying to manage yourself. So the place that we stayed was very magical for me. I loved it. I wrote parts of the Mapmaker Chronicles series there on the deck, staring out at the ocean, pretending to be Quinn, you know, like floating about out there, imagining what it's like. So there was a sort of that aspect to it. And we just had really great memories. And it was owned by some friends of my husband's, Faye and Ray. And I just said to them, because they sold the house, and I just said to them, I'm going to write a story set here one day. And they harassed me for years, like, when's this story coming? When's this story coming? But it took me a while to find the right story to set in this place that I love so much. And it wasn't until I sort of met Callie that I had the right story for this place. But having said that, I drafted the story 6 years ago. Like, the first draft of this story I wrote 6 years ago. And then it just has taken me a while to find, because I was writing a lot of the almost history, fantasy, adventure sort of stuff. And when you write that and it does well, that's what people expect of you. So then to have this story that's not that exactly, like, it's, as I said, still adventure mystery, but it doesn't have this fantasy element to it. You know, it's there's a level of trust that you need with a publisher to be able to then bring that out as your next book. So it's just taken me some time to get the story right and to get the, you know, to get the conditions right in which to, you know, to put this book out. So I'm very happy that, you know, the first summer of Callie McGee is out there, and I do hope that people love her and the place as much as I do.
That's really nice. So we wanted to chat a little bit about, like, writing for a middle grade audience. Why do you think it's so appealing, not only just to children in that age group, but to sort of kids of all ages, as you say on your podcast?
It's definitely kids of all ages. Look, I think for me, the middle grade space is very much where my writing voice, my storytelling voice, really sits. I love them as an audience because they are, so there's a couple of things about them. They are willing to go anywhere with you as long as you give them a good reason. A middle grade audience, you know, you want unicorns and, you know, I don't know, exploding meteors, you can do that as long as it makes sense in the world that you've created. They will be like, yep, I am on board for this. So they're very enthusiastic. Like, I fully believe that there is no audience more enthusiastic for a school visit than grade five. Grade five, you know, when they're about 10 and they're all swept up in reading because they're reading more interesting things, they're reading by themselves, they're getting completely and utterly absorbed in the book, and they are still young enough to kind of not have too many other distractions. You know, once you get into that sort of even sort of 13, 14-year-old space, there's a lot of call on their time and a lot of other things that will distract them. But, you know, 10-year-olds, they are there for you. So I love that. Like, it's a very enthusiastic audience. The other thing I love about this sort of middle grade space is that, for me, these kids are, you know, on the cusp of the greatest adventure that any of us ever go through, and that is from going from being a child to being an adult. They have all of these years ahead of them, you know, and all of the various challenges and joys and all of that stuff of going through their teens, and you can just feel them. They're sort of on the cusp of it, and I love writing for that. And I also think that I remember it really well. I think you write for the space, as a children's author, you write for the space that stands out for you the most. And when I was 10 years old, we moved from the Northern Territory to New South Wales. I started my fifth primary school. I got a new brother. I've got a brother who's 10 years younger than me, so I have two sisters in between, and then this brother. So it was just this massive sort of time of transition for me. And I think because of that, it's where I go in my head when I think about childhood, because, you know, if you don't have really strong childhood memories, it's because your childhood was just pretty good, you know, like you're just kind of like vibing along. True. Every day is the same. You can't remember what year things happened, but, you know, you have those big moments. Everyone's got them. They happen at different ages. And I think, you know, for me, that was a big moment and it really stood out. And so I think when I think about writing for children, I'm there. I'm her. Like, I'm back there. And I remember what it's like to be 12. I remember what it's like to, you know, be about to go to high school and to be going through all of that stuff and wanting to be better. You know, you have this idea in your head that, you know, if you weren't yourself, that everything would be better. And it takes a long time for us to work out that being ourselves is enough. And some people don't get to that point till they're 50, you know? So like, if you can figure that out when you're 13, then you are on fire as far as I'm concerned.
And I like that thought too of like responding to the adventure of the story, because the adventure's beginning for you. That's really cool.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And you've written across multiple time periods in the middle grade space. And the tone between, say, Maven and Reeve and Callie Thorpe is quite different because they're set in different time periods. What's the process of shaping language and tone to not only suit those different time periods, but also to appeal to young readers at the same time? Because situating a sort of Middle Ages-y type book, you know, with the typical kind of language that generally happens for adults, is quite a challenge to read for us. So how did you make that accessible for young people?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I don't know that there's a conscious process in that. It's a funny thing, because I think one of the things you always want to do before you start writing anything is to read a lot in that space. Like, you need to have an understanding of what the conventions are of that sort of genre, what the sort of conventions are of the age group that you're writing for and that sort of thing. So when I sit down to write, you know, the Mapmaker Chronicles or Maven and Reeve, so that those two, so the Mapmaker Chronicles was the first series I wrote for kids, and then Maven and Reeve was the most recent series, you know, in the fantasy adventure space. And they are actually I had two different age groups in mind for those. So the Mapmaker Chronicles is very much the 8 to 12 space. You know, I had... was writing for my own kids at that point. So Joe, my oldest, was 9, and Lucas, my youngest, was 6. And we were reading a lot in that. They loved those sort of really big, you know, stories, vivid characters. They loved the Ranger's Apprentice and that sort of space, Brother Band. They were on board for that. So we were sort of like in that zone. And one of the things I think that is great about those kinds of stories is that the voice is accessible. So the language doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, dumbed down. I never dumb down. Like, I never think about I'm writing for a 9-year-old. I can't use that word. Never, ever do that. So for me, it's always the right word in the right place, but it's the voice that's the key to it. So I'm sort of thinking about accessibility. There's a certain sense of humor that runs through all of my books that is modern. It's not, you know, ye olde worldy sort of idea. And I'm sort of thinking, I'm cherry picking the bits and pieces that I need to build a world that is accessible for my younger readers. So I'm not going to write three paragraphs of description of a castle or three paragraphs of description of a forest or anything like that. But what I am going to do is make sure that that world is built in sort of a sentence here and a detail there, and what are they eating and what are they wearing and those sorts of things. So I think with kids, you know, you'll read if you read a sort of historical fiction for adults, for instance, there'll always be a lot of detail around the gloves and the, you know, what, you know, the neckline and where the dress is and all that sort of stuff. Kids don't care about that. They just want to know the vague sort of outline of what everybody's got in their head, because they will fill the rest in. They will fill it in because they've seen enough kind of other things by now. But you've got to remember, we're dealing with a very visual generation. So there's a lot of stuff that you can, even when you're writing about an oldie worldie sort of a world, you throw in a sword and a cloak and some breeches and they are in the space. They kind of get, they know what's going on. And then it's about creating the world with the tiny details of what they eat, what they talk about, you know, where they are, going downstairs into the castle kitchens. I'm going to talk a little bit about what those spaces look like. And you build those pictures. So I don't have to describe every single room in the castle for them to know that they're in a castle. I'm going to talk about how many turrets there might be on the outside, and they will build that picture. So it's that. I actually found, to be honest with you, and I know this sounds slightly weird, but I actually found the contemporary world harder when I was writing Callie, because you have to get it right with the contemporary world. You know, it's got to be, you have to get it right. And you have to be so careful around technology, and you have to be so careful around slang, and you've got to really be careful about the relationships between younger kids and older kids and things like that, because it feels more real. Kids will think it's more real. Whereas, you know, when they're reading the Mapmaker Chronicles or Maven and Reeve, they know it's not of this world. They know it's somewhere else. You get away with a lot more. I can have them drinking ale. I can have them throwing themselves into a river with, you know, rivers with abandon. I can have them doing all of those things. Whereas when I'm thinking about Callie going into the ocean to chase a kid in a rip, I've got to think really hard about how I set that up, because I don't want every kid who reads the book to think that that's okay. I want them to know that she's got knowledge and understanding, and she's got background, and she's got some practical skills. You know, she's been a nipper. She's been in surf lifesaving. She understands how, she's a really good swimmer. I set that up, you know, because her mum is very anxious. And so mum's made sure she can swim 5K, and mum's made sure that she understands how to look after herself in the ocean. So I give good reasons why these things happen. And then I can do this, you know, whereas if I just had her diving in and swimming off, I would have complaints, you know, from gatekeepers saying, well, this is irresponsible. And I don't want to be irresponsible. I want to tell a great story, but I want to do it in a responsible way. And I have to be very careful around the use of technology for the same reason. And I don't use slang, because slang dates so quickly. So a word that is, you know, very, very hot right now is going to be completely out of date in 3 years' time. So, you know, when I'm writing fantasy adventure, I just make my own up. Like, I can have whatever I want. I throw swear words in that are not swear words, but are obviously read as swear words, whereas I would never throw actual swear words into a middle grade novel. So, you know, there's certain things to think about. But as far as the actual language itself goes, for middle grade, I'm not dumbing it down. I'm trying to stick with the voice that I've created for the book, and stay, you know, true and authentic to that voice.
And I really love that. And that really does come across when I read you, is that you trust your audience, you know, you trust your audience to get there themselves. And
absolutely.
And that's a really beautiful thing to do, I think.
Well, middle grade's an interesting one too, because you are writing most definitely for your audience. You are also writing for adults to read to your audience as well. And then you are also writing for adults who like to read middle grade. So there's sort of like, there's a whole lot of levels. But for me, it's always about that sort of 10 to 12 year old reader. Like that's my, that reader is my main focus. And then all of the other things around it, again, it's about the voice. It's about dragging the voice, you know, dragging in the adults with the voice. And sort of, and that sort of, it's not, I don't write slapsticky laugh out loud, but I, there's always that undercurrent of mostly language humor. So it's kind of like, it's in the voice, it's in that sort of like subversive sort of, you know, sense of looking at the world, and characters being smart with each other. I love characters being smart with each other. Like smart mouth dialogue is, I'm absolutely here for that.
Yeah, acerbic. That acerbic kind of.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Those exchanges. Yeah, for sure.
Yes.
We all love that.
We do.
We all wish we could be that so easily.
We do. In real life. How good would it be to just be like.
To have that easy wit, you know?
Yeah, I wish I was scripted all the time.
Life would be easier if, we, if it was just all scripted, I think. Yeah,
it would be so good. Our next question was sort of about that authentic voice, but I think you've just described like quite a thoughtful process of how you approach that, and you've already talked about that, which was really nice, of having such clarity and such authenticity in the setting as well as the characters. So, that, I mean, you've already answered a question, so...
Yeah.
Moving on.
I think it just sort of comes back to knowing your you kind of have to really know your characters, and it's a weird thing because I don't actually plan my novels. So for me, I am getting to know my characters in the first draft, in the same way that readers get to know them as they read once, you know, the edited version. So when I'm writing a first draft, I'm discovering things about my characters as I go, and about their families, and about the, therefore about the story, because the character for me will always drive the story. It is always about what the character, what their goal is, and then it's about what are they willing to do to get to that goal, and also how can I make it as difficult as possible, because writers are just horrible. So I'm going to make it as difficult as possible. So I'm always just like, the first draft is me figuring things out, and then the second draft is the reader sitting on my shoulder and me thinking, okay, what do I need to put on the page to make sure that this reader understands this character as well as I now understand this character? So, yeah, it's an interesting process because, yeah, I'm writing a book at the moment. I've just started a new one and I'm working through the first chapter. And as I'm writing the first chapter, I'm discovering the voice of this character. I'm discovering, I know where she's come from. I have an understanding of where she's going, but I'm figuring out all these things about her as I go, about how she feels about where she is. And it is absolutely why I'm a writer. This bit of the process of like this drafting and the, particularly the first draft and finding out what happens to this person is why I do it. Because it's where all the fun is, and then everything else is just really hard work.
So is this one that you're starting to write, is this, I think you described sister novels to the Kelly McGee one?
Well, I'm sort of thinking about, yeah, trying to kind of put some sister novel ideas together. That's sort of where I am at the moment. Whether that happens or not, all comes back to, you know, it's my decision about what I write, but it's a publisher's decision about what they're willing to publish. So it's
one
kind
you're
of like
at the moment isn't one of those. It's a different one.
No, I'm working on some other things. Yeah, I've always got several projects on the go. And I try very hard to focus on one at a time. Like when I say they're on the go, I will have one where I am actually actively writing the manuscript, but then I will have a couple of other ideas, and those ones, all I'm doing with them is as something occurs to me, I have files open on my computer. You do not want to see my computer. I've got files open everywhere. It's a bit like my brain, and I'm dropping ideas into those files all the time. Like I know I have friends like Kate Forsyth who uses a notebook for every book, but I just find, well, A, my handwriting's terrible and I can't read it, but I just find the process of actually typing it is what unlocks it for me. So I'm sort of dropping links and dropping ideas into these files, and hopefully at some point they'll become books. Who knows?
Sure. One of the lines that I appreciated quite early on in The Wolf's Howl was, nobody likes a girl who asks questions, least of all a man who asks none.
Great line.
I love it with my big feminist heart.
I love the fact that you love that because, you know, sometimes you're right. Sometimes you put these things just come out of you and you put them in and you think, oh, I hope someone out there loves that as much as I do. I'm so glad that you do.
A couple of levels. Like it's very clever. But the lack of female agency in that time period is upheld in your world. So you could have just written that out. It's a fantastical setting. But you chose, I imagine consciously, to keep that in, and you also poke it in the ribs. So like throughout the Maven and Reeve stories, a lack of female agency is quite the player.
It's a massive part of that story because it's a massive part of Maven's story, and it's a huge part of what she's about. She wants to get out of it. And so when I'm looking at a character and a goal, Maven's goal is to get out. And for her, if you're going to set that up, you've got to make what she's getting out of very, very clear and very apparent. And so... Also the reality for so many people for so many years, and even now in places, you know, like it's not like it's gone anywhere. So I loved her because she gave me a modern sensibility in an oldie worldy place, you know, and she's very much because I she's actually inspired in some ways by women of my mother's generation my mother's an incredibly smart person who never really got the opportunity to do what she wanted to do because of the way things were. And I'm only talking about the 50s and 60s here. Like we're not going back too far here. And it's been, I think, incredibly frustrating for her on so many levels. So you kind of watch that and that sense of frustration that comes through in that, and imagining what it would be like to, I imagine what it would be like to be me in a place where I can't do the things I want to do, where I can't read and I can't write and I can't, because someone else tells me that that's not what we do, right? And so it's not difficult for me to imagine being Maven in that space and imagine what kinds of lengths I might go to were I that person to get out of that world or to make changes or to do what I can, you know. And when you're one person, it's very difficult. So, you know, what do you need? You need a gang, don't you? So she has the Beach Circle, and they are an underground. I'm fascinated by sort of those underground networks, that were moving people around in the wars or were, you know, in America, and just this notion of this group of people working together behind the scenes, like pulling, you know, doing what they can, just really appealed to me. So those books bring together a whole lot of my preoccupations in, as books do, like the writer's preoccupations come out in them. And I think that those books in particular, I love the Maven and Reeve mysteries. Like I'm so proud of them because they are complex mysteries. They are written in two points of view. They address a whole range of really interesting subjects to me, but they're also just cracking stories. So at the end of the day, I'm a writer and I'm writing for a middle grade audience, and what I want to give them is a cracking story. And coming up with those mysteries, as someone who has read crime novels and mystery stories my whole entire life, like since I could read, since I was four, five, whatever, creating those mysteries was just such a brilliant challenge. And so I was so incredibly excited by how they came together and the sort of solutions. And I think that, as a writer, you can only write the stories you can write. And those were the stories that brought together a whole lot of stuff I was looking at the time, what was in the news. Like, you don't necessarily think, you know, like that the Me Too movement and those sorts of things are coming out in a middle grade novel that's set in a world that doesn't exist, in castles and knights and stuff, but it does. It is.
And it very much felt like that for me. Like as I was reading it, I was like, this feels very post Me Too relevant. Mm. You know, like it's very important, I think, for young women to have access to that,
yeah,
to those stories, but also to, well, this is how you counter that, and this is, you get to poke it in the ribs, you get to be angry about it, and you get to be mad about it and frustrated about it. And I think that that's one of the things about these stories that I love so much, is that you give young women you make that rage almost accessible to young people, which is fantastic.
I think so, and I think it's about sort of harnessing that rage. But you know, I also love I love Reeve in that book as well, in those books as well, because you know he's someone who is very at home in his world. He's very much the, you know, he's an up and comer. He's quite political. He understands how things work in castles, and when he's challenged by Maven, he recognises that he's not always the smartest person in the room, and I think all of my male protagonists are like that. And I think the Adaban Cipher novels, even the Book of Secrets and the Book of Answers. So you know, we've got Gabe who's grown up in a monastery where everything is black and white. Good is this, you know, bad is that, and then he finds himself out in the real world. So he's grown up surrounded by men. So when you've got a character that's grown up surrounded by men, the first thing you want to do as a writer is challenge that. Well, I do. That would just be me. So he goes up over the walls with this book that he has to keep safe, you know, out of his very cloistered existence into a world he's only seen through the windows. And, you know, the first kind of people he runs across are these four girls who've been living in a tree on their own because their father and uncle has been, you know, imprisoned for reasons, nefarious reasons. And so they get by, they get on, and they understand that the world is not black and white, that they're, you know, what is good in one place is not necessarily good in another place, you know, and that you need to get outside your own tower, you got to get outside your own walls and start to understand what other people's experiences are like before you can start making these black and white decisions. And so I think that those stories, you know, again, brought together a whole lot of my preoccupations. I have a love of illuminated manuscripts. I went to see the Book of Kells. I've been twice. So I've seen two pages because they only open one page a day. And I've been twice at, you know, two different periods. And each time that I have seen it, the thing that I remember most about it is how much I wanted it. I wanted that book so badly. I coveted that thing. I just wanted to like reach in and just take it home with me because it was beautiful and it was special. Like you could feel it. So that's what the Adaban Cipher is too. Like so many people want this thing because of that, because it's this, you know, valuable item, but it's also just beautiful and people want to have it. So that comes through in the book as well. So you're dragging in all of these feelings and all of these sort of things you see and all of the things that you love, and you're creating, again, a cracking story. I love those stories as well. I love those girls. Gwyn, I think, is one of my finest creations of ever. You know, she's the girl who goes where she wants, when she wants. And I'm just like, I'm still not that girl. I want to be that girl, you know? And I dedicate the book to the girls who you know, go where they want, when they want, or will one day. And I think that's the driving force behind that book, even though the protagonist is male and you know, is very much, you know, he's very much a male. But he also starts to recognize that he's not the smartest guy in the forest, you know, like it's someone else might know a bit more, but he's open to it. He gets to be open to it. He starts to realize that if he's not open to it, then he's going to get left behind, and he can't afford to be left behind.
And I love that too. I love that. Mm-hmm. Feels very relevant and contemporary at the moment too. The idea that we have these young men and men in general that are opening up to these ideas. It's fantastic.
Absolutely. And again, I've got two two young men in my house of my own, and watching them go through this process of kind of, you know, they've been living through the last few years. You know, we've had with, particularly with my youngest, we've had the Andrew Tate discussions. And the thing with those conversations is it's important to understand where they're coming from, why they're coming there, and then you have to start unpacking all of the reasons why, you know, because it's peer, you know, it's a peer thing, and it's all these boys, and they're all looking for meaning, and they're all looking for reasons. And so the ones I feel sad about are the ones who don't have a counter voice at home, the ones who don't have somebody opening up those discussions and saying, actually, you know, no, this is, you know, whatever. Like, I remember my younger son coming home one day and saying to me one day, wouldn't you rather just have like stayed home and looked after us and not had to work and stuff? And I just looked at him and I'm like, have you met me? Like, have we actually met? Like, can you imagine me in that situation? And he sort of looked at me and he sort of thought about it for a minute. He went, yeah, no, I think things have worked out pretty well, haven't they? I'm like, yeah, I think so. I think so, darling. Your Let's continue as we are.
The alternative would have been a chaotic nightmare. No, thank you.
No, that's right. It would have been Maven, you know, trying to escape across the water at any minute, yeah.
Something that I notice when I listen to you on other podcasts is what a wonderful interviewer you are.
Thank you.
Yes, and so I wondered if you had any sort of quick tips for us when we are interviewing people, like how do you get the best out of people, Alison? How can we, you know, express the best in ourselves as well when we're doing things like that?
I think like one thing I've just learned over years and years of interviewing, because I was a magazine journalist before I ever started podcasting or anything like that, and you learn very, very quickly as a young journalist, particularly. I remember my salutary lesson in this space. I did an interview with somebody in a cafe one time, and that was my first mistake because it was hard for me to hear the recording, but I realized that I talked too much. Like I realized that I was having too much of this conversation. So when it came for me to write the story, I didn't have enough quotes because I had talked too much. So that was my first lesson. So it's kind of like, and it's even more important on podcasts, is to leave the space for the person that you're interviewing to actually, you know, talk about. I always say that the best interviews are not about the answers, they are about the questions. So I think really hard about what I want to know before I actually speak to somebody. And what I'm trying to do, particularly when I'm talking to writers, is I'm trying to get something out of them that hasn't been said 1,000 times before. Because, you know, writers, particularly, you know, high profile writers are very much practiced at what they talk about. So I'm looking for a question that is going to make them go, oh, bit like your question about the voice and the, I haven't been asked that one before. So you want a question that's going to make them go, oh, I have to actually think about that. Yeah. So I think really hard about the questions, and particularly if I'm on a narrow time frame, like I am with the 10 minutes interviews with Your Kids Next Read, I never make 10 minutes. Let's just be frank about that. But I have to narrow it in. I've got to really kind of hone in on what I want to know about this particular book or this particular author. So I focus very hard on the questions. It's all about the questions. And then I leave room. That's kind of like where I go or try to. Yeah.
In that, we are very, very lucky enough to have you come along in November to the library to our second annual National dun, Novel dun, Writing Month. Can you tell us and our listeners a little bit about what the participants of that workshop are likely to expect?
Okay, so I'm going to be talking about the middle, because by the time we get to my workshop, we will be, you know, approaching the halfway mark of NaNoWriMo. So technically we're about halfway through the book. And I will say without any sort of a lie that the middle of the book is the hardest bit for me always. So it's about kind of honing in on why things might be petering out for you. I had a conversation with someone in my Write with Alison Tate group the other day who said, I lose interest. I get halfway through the book and I lose interest. I just don't know what to do with my characters anymore. So we're going to address those sorts of things. We're going to look at whether or not your stakes are high enough. We're going to look at whether or not you have enough conflict. Conflict is what drives stories. So we are focusing on getting you from the beginning, which is all very exciting and fun and yay, to the end, which is also very exciting, fun, and yay. It's this bit in the middle, which is the hardest bit of the book to write. That's what we're going to be discussing.
That will be exciting. I wish I could attend it.
Feel free to come along. I'll be very entertaining.
Right? We might just have to leave work alone and just duck in and enjoy the process.
It's a valid reason.
Yes.
I think so.
So, Alison, tell everyone where they can find you online to wrap it up.
Well, you can find me at alisontait.com, alisontait.com. You'll find me on Facebook and Instagram. I used to be on Twitter, but Twitter's no fun anymore, so I don't go there much anymore. You can also find me... You can also find me at yourkidsnextread.com. We're just launching a brand new website. It's very exciting, but that's where you'll find all the show notes and episodes for our podcast, where we talk about, you know, books and reading for kids of all ages. So I'm all over. Actually, I'm kind of embarrassingly all over the internet.
Very accessible, which is great. Thank you so much for speaking to us today. We're so grateful.
Thanks for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. You've made me think about a few things there that I might need to. I'm going to go and write those things down. That's the other thing. If people ask me an interesting question and I come up with an answer that's vaguely coherent, I write it down. And then what I often do is write a blog post or something about it later.
Oh, amazing. Great idea.
Oh, I love that. I would love for us to feature in your blog post.
You will feature in my blog post. I got asked this really, really hard question and here it is.
Oh, very good. Well, thank you very much. And hopefully we'll catch up again soon. Otherwise, we'll see you in November.
You will.
See you in November, Al.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
So it was so nice to chat to Alison about middle grade fiction. She's so intelligent, isn't she? She's so considered in everything she says and does and interesting in the way she crafts her stories and appeals to an age group that's just crying out for adventurous, clever stories, and I just love her. So, the Your Kids Next Read podcast is definitely worth a listen if you're a mum of kids in that range, or if you're a librarian stocking your middle grade collection, or you just want to listen to, as they describe it, some quality waffle.
It is quality waffle. It's fantastic. Yeah, hard recommend from us.
So for I Just Can't Help Myself, we're going to continue the interview party and briefly chat with our children's librarian, Elizabeth. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is quite a thrill to be part of the Good Librations podcast.
I love that for you. I love it for us too.
I feel very special.
It's really nice. How long have you been working at Kiama Libraries for now?
I've been here for 12 years, probably about half of that as the children's librarian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a very good one she is.
Oh, thank you, girls. Positive affirmations are always great.
that's what we live for. It's great.
So we just wanted to ask you about why you think middle grade books are so important in a child's reading journey and their development overall. Just a very small question for you to answer.
Yes. I'll just get my 1,000-word essay out about that one. I have had a little think about this, and I'm sure I'm probably going to reiterate things that you've already said and that you know anyway, but I feel like the middle grade books are a great bridge for children between the learn-to-read-y type small chapter books, and then kind of like the YA, you know, the youth fiction sort of area. So they're not only bigger in size and more words, but they start to deal with slightly more complex things that happen in kids' lives that are relatable. And I think they gradually provide that sort of crossover. Kids are at the point where they can actually read without too much kind of supervision or parental involvement, and so they can get engrossed in stories. and start enjoying just reading for the joy of reading.
Yes.
And reading some really cool.
Yeah, they're so
story.
Cool. Story.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yes.
So that's in a nutshell. That's the yeah. brief version of my 1,000-word essay.
We could talk for many more hours. So why do you think middle grade books are so appealing then to children, but also, like we were saying, how much we enjoy occasionally reading yeah. in that age group. So what do you think is the appeal of that, really?
Okay, so I think the appeal of them is that often things happen in these books that are very relatable for the children. They start to see a little bit outside the world of their family and their parents, mm-hmm. and they're out in a broader community. They're at that age at school where they're sort of probably, you know, what are we talking about, year 4 or 5,
yep.
up to perhaps year 7. So they come across situations in their real life that then they also come across in these books, and they can kind of relate to those. And that yep. begins the journey of creating empathy in children when they can kind of relate to people and characters in stories as well. Like we've already said, there's lots of themes in them, you know, friendship and family, you know, things that happen while they're growing up. They might deal with some bullying, and there might be a character in a book that they can relate to. Yeah, but sure. also getting away from that sort of serious side, they just can be fun and entertaining, because yes. there's some really cool, you know, fantasy middle grade books, or I don't know, just lots of stuff that they can just have fun with and yep. enjoy reading, that are funny, you know, and yeah. they can laugh.
Like
and
a step up from those learning to read yeah. ones, like you say, where you're like pulled into a story.
Yeah, the yep. plots are a little bit more complex, so that's also great for them. Sometimes the little chapter books and the learn to read books can get a bit boring, because sure. there's not much in them, really.
Repetitive.
Other than, okay, let's just yep. get through this and learn how to read all these different words and recognise them. But these books start to provide that bit of complexity that they need at this point in time. And also because they're kind of in between the chaptery thing and the you know, the sort of YA stuff, they're often books that they can get through fairly quickly.
Yeah.
Unless it's something like, you know, the later volumes of Harry Potter or whatever. Sure. You might not read those in a day, but that kind of thing.
Yes.
So
digestible yeah. and you feel like you're achieving something on your own, I suppose. Then,
yeah,
too.
Yep. Absolutely. So I'm just, when you said about you guys, you also enjoy reading them, I was thinking about my husband recently read Runt, which is a book
right.
that I was going to, this will be later on in the conversation, but he absolutely loved it. You know,
yes.
that is definitely a middle grade book.
Yes.
And he would say that's the best thing he's read in ages. Like Runt by Craig Silvey, which
yes.
is a CBCA shortlisted prize winner.
Yes.
Which you may know or may not.
It's on my list to read.
Yeah,
I must read it.
Yeah. And think about, and I know we're going to talk about this as well, the Harry Potter series. How many adults just absorbed those? I
Absolutely.
Know we did.
Yes.
Our kids were of the age where they really enjoyed reading them themselves, but we just consumed them ourselves as well. Like, and that's
right.
definitely, you know, fits in that middle grade category, especially the first few books of Harry Potter.
So. Yes. And I suppose too, looking back on that age group, like we all have like fierce nostalgia for that. And you kind of remember all of those things that you went through yourself, and
yep.
it's, yeah, it's lovely. I love it.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking about me personally. I know we were kind of going to try and talk about more recent things, but for me personally, at that age, I remember distinctly my mum buying me the Anne of Green Gables books.
Oh, yes.
And they were just the best.
The best.
You know, just so
still the best.
Good. And I just loved them, consumed them. I think it was probably the first female character
mm-hmm.
like that mm-hmm. I read about and kind of went, oh, okay, yeah, I can understand how you feel or
yeah.
what's
yeah.
going on here.
And didn't we all want to have a bosom friend?
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And a Gilbert.
And a Gilbert.
Oh, gosh, you guys are good at remembering
some of
character names. I can remember Anne.
Great series, that one.
Great series.
So, on that, can you give us 3 recommendations of newer middle grade fiction that families would maybe enjoy reading together, or that you might suggest for that age group to read?
Okay, so I actually did bring along some I've brought them here, physically for only the people out there can actually see through the airwaves. So I already mentioned Runt by Craig Silvey.
Yes.
Highly recommend.
Yes, it that. Seems to be universally beloved. Yes.
Definitely. And that is recent, and I've already mentioned things that I like to read, but the books I've brought along because not only have they been shortlisted and won prizes for the CBCA Book Week Awards this year, but they have excellent reviews. I can't confess that I've read them all, but the first one's called The Way of the Dog by Zana Freilon. And what attracted me to it actually originally was that the picture of the dog on the front is almost exactly like my own dog.
Oh,
and so my little Pippa. So it made me pick it up, and which that is often a thing about a book is the cover.
Or the artwork, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, and the artwork. But it's all about a journey for a particular scruffy dog and, you know, hard life. And things happen through the story. You know, he goes up and down in his little journey of life, and it all kind of ends up kind of nicely in the end. So that's a kind of relatable thing for kids, I think, to it's read like that.
A Bildungsroman for a dog.
Yeah.
It's the Odyssey. Exactly. It's the Odyssey again.
Yeah. So that's available here at the library and an excellent, you know, suggestion. The other one is August and Jones by Pip Harry, and Pip Harry is... very well known, you know, author. Once again, this is an 11-year-old, just moved to the country, sorry, to the city from the country, and has lots of things that they're getting used to. They have health issues and lots of stuff that, you know, are tough. And it just kind of talks about how they work through all those different challenges in life. Just ordinary kids, you know. August and Jones, obviously, great friends, become great friends in the story. Another one I picked out was... Evie and Rhino by Nerida McMullen, and that's kind of a story between a human and an animal set back. It's historical, so it's set back in the 1800s, and Evie comes across this kind of creature after a huge storm that got kind of washed up on the beach. And I was just imagining how I would be as a 10-year-old, this is, and how I'd feel if I came across a rhino on the beach. Sure. And what I do, because I loved animals when I was a kid.
Pretty
and,
happy.
Yeah, pretty happy. And so...
That's the dream.
Yeah, so I think that would be just very appealing and an excellent book for this particular middle grade age group we're talking about. And lastly, I've got The Raven's Song. That's by same author again.
Another one by Zana.
Yeah. And Ben McDibble as well. But... little bit of, you know, sort of fantasy type stuff. Once again, you know, friends that go through, you know, dangerous situations and do some daring deeds and sort things out together. And it'll be a great read. So if anyone out there is interested, come in and see us at the library, and we'll set you on the path for some great reads in that area.
I love that.
Thank you so much for those.
Thanks for talking to us, Liz.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Anytime.
Great.
We love that.
So thanks for joining us today. Don't forget to follow Kiama Library on social media and check out the podcast page of our website for links to everything we spoke about today. And if you have time, rate and review wherever you can.
Our next topic is going to be bibliotherapy. Which you just made sound so exciting. Hopefully we can deliver on that.
It's going to be exciting.
Thanks for sticking with us. See you next time.
Bye.